This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we'll hear excerpts from leading Yemeni activists and a CCR human rights attorney from a forum titled The United States in Yemen, Destroying Lives in the Name of National Security.
President Obama announced the withdrawal of American troops from Iraq.
He's getting good at sleight of hand. Now you see it, now you don't. But unfortunately, they're still in Iraq.
Stay with us. Go now to hear the voices of leading Yemeni activists and a CCR human rights attorney speaking on state violence, targeted killings, and human rights abuses enabled by the so-called War on Terror from the Brecht Forum event titled The United States in Yemen, Destroying Lives in the Name of National Security. The event was co-sponsored by the International Federation for Human Rights and the Brecht Forum. We hear first from Pardis Cabriai, staff attorney at the Center for Constitutional Rights. She joined the Guantanamo Global Justice Initiative at CCR in July 2007 and provides direct representation to several of CCR's clients at Guantanamo. She is also working on a lawsuit to challenge a U.S. government kill list and the targeting of a U.S. citizen now in Yemen and far from any armed conflict with the United States. We will then hear from Tawakkol Karman, chairwoman of the Yemeni non-government organization Women Journalists Without Chains, which campaigns for freedom of the press in Yemen and against human rights violations. She's a prominent young activist, and Reporters Without Borders chose her in 2009 as one of the top seven women who have led change in the world. Karman is among the activists who in 2007 launched the Phase of Protests and Sit-ins in Yemen, holding regular sit-ins in the capital's Freedom Square to demand democratic reforms and an end to human rights violations, including the harassment and imprisonment of journalists and dissidents, closure of critical newspapers, and censorship of news articles.
Hello, everyone. I'm Leili Kashani, and I'd like to welcome you all tonight to this critical and timely discussion. We've titled The United States and Yemen, Destroying Lives in the Name of National Security. Thank you to the Brecht Forum for hosting us. There are not enough public places where discussions like this take place and can happen. I'm delighted to have been able to organize this panel as an advocate at the Center for Constitutional Rights, and also welcome Tawakkol Karman and Ezzeddine Asbahi in particular, who we are very fortunate to have with us tonight. So thank you for joining us, Tawakkol and Ezzeddine. Tonight's discussion will center around the human and legal consequences of characterizing Yemen as a new frontier in the so-called war on terror. The U.S. government increasingly describes Yemen as an important partner in the global war on terrorism, while at the same time characterizing it as an al-Qaeda stronghold. Can everyone hear me okay? Perfect. Just today, the Wall Street Journal reported that the U.S. Military Central Command has proposed pumping as much as $1.2 billion over 5 years into building up Yemen's so-called security forces, and the U.S. provided $155 million to train and equip Yemeni forces in fiscal year 2010. That's up from $67 million in 2009. And the White House is now reportedly weighing a proposal to add armed aerial drones operated by the CIA to target alleged militants in Yemen, mirroring the CIA's drone program in Pakistan. Meanwhile, the United States' military's most elite counterterrorism forces, the Joint Special Operations Command, otherwise known as JSOC, is reported to have been operating in Yemen for years, carrying out a variety of operations, including killings. U.S. airstrikes in Yemen have already caused significant civilian casualties. Just one December 17, 2009 strike killed 41 civilians, mostly women and children, leading to popular protest. Thousands of people took to the streets of southern Yemen to denounce the military action and ensuing deaths of innocent civilians, for which there has been no recognition or accountability in the United States. In turn, the Yemeni government has taken advantage of the U.S. partnership and increasing military aid to justify its own domestic anti-terror campaigns, which have resulted in egregious human rights violations, including mass arrests, illegal abductions, enforced disappearances, torture, and killings. The victims of this violence are not only alleged militants and their families, but Yemeni dissidents and journalists critical of their government. Just today, Yemeni authorities broke up a sit-in protest near the presidential palace to demand the release of two critical journalists, Abdelilah Haidar Shai, an Al-Qaeda specialist, and political cartoonist Kamal Sharafuddin, imprisoned for about 2 weeks now. The war on terror has served as a cover for the Yemeni state to increase repression and militarization in response to its own internal political crises, all with the tacit approval of the international community. Last autumn, Yemen's armed forces unleashed a massive aerial assault on the Sadr region in the north, killing hundreds and, according to Amnesty International, possibly thousands of civilians in the bombings. The Yemeni state is also committing human rights abuses in the south in its attempt to repress a going secessionist movement with political demands. Our Yemeni guests tonight are activists at the forefront of human rights struggles and political struggles in their country. We will discuss what they are doing to resist this mounting repression and to create a meaningfully democratic and peaceful future there. Pardis Kebriyai, my colleague, and a CCR attorney, will discuss the case she just filed to stop the U.S. from carrying out a so-called targeted killing in Yemen. Pardis also represents men detained at Guantanamo, where Yemeni men constitute the largest group of remaining prisoners, all declared by the Obama administration to be indefinitely detainable without charge based solely on their nationality. Together, I hope we can think through what ethical solidarity with the Yemeni people might look like. Together, we must work to end the U.S. government's complicity in and responsibility for grave human rights abuses, and to stop the creation of a war without boundaries or end that threatens our collective safety.
Thank you, Layli. Thank you all for staying. I wish I could speak in Arabic, but I guess I'll just stick to my English. I wanted to focus specifically on the role of the United States in contributing to the deteriorating human rights and human security situation in Yemen, and then at the same time, using that very deteriorating situation that it is contributing to and creating to justify other policies of the United States with respect to Yemen. And I wanted to talk about two specific aspects of CCR's work to illustrate these points. One being our work on Guantanamo and specifically the men we've represented from Yemen. And the other being the case that Layli mentioned that we filed on Monday with the ACLU that addresses the issue of targeted killings by this administration, not just in recognized war zones of Afghanistan and Iraq, but outside of those zones in countries like Yemen. So I'll start with the issue of targeted killings. This is nothing new. The United States has been, for years, has claimed the authority to be able to target suspects of terrorism anywhere in the world. And it has been firing missiles and conducting raids in Yemen and in other countries since 2001. Shortly after 9/11, President Bush issued a classified order authorizing the CIA to go into any country in the world and use force against suspects of al-Qaeda. In 2004, there was a memo that Secretary of Defense Rumsfeld, with the approval of President Bush, authorized the U.S. military to use the same kind of tactics to capture or kill suspects, again, suspects being the operative word, of al-Qaeda in any country in the world. In Yemen, the first reported strike by the CIA actually was in November of 2002 against an alleged al-Qaeda member that killed six people who were unintended targets of that. That was a killing that at the time the United Nations Special Rapporteur on Extrajudicial Killing and Amnesty International and others condemned as a clear violation of the law and a clear extrajudicial killing. So again, this is just to say this is not new. The United States has carried out targeted assassinations before and after 2001. But what is slightly new or different is the way that this administration has escalated the use of targeted killings as a specific strategy in conducting its war, again, not just in Afghanistan and Iraq, but in countries outside of those zones. And if you sort of track, I was looking back at headlines back from when President Obama was first elected, and it's interesting, you can really track the escalation itself. So you had in November, beginning in about November of 2008, when Obama was first elected, a lot of partisan calls by Republican leaders in opposition to then President-elect Obama's promise to close Guantanamo. Responses and attacks to that, basically claiming that the majority of detainees, again, who are Yemeni, could not be returned because of concerns about Yemen's capacity to absorb them and monitor them effectively. There were periodic reports that surfaced every few months about recidivism of released detainees, again, unnamed detainees. These were secret reports, not substantiated, but that were strategically sort of, would come to light at various moments, again, as part of an attack, essentially, on efforts to close Guantanamo. Interestingly, when the sort of partisan response sort of started, what really demonstrates the hypocrisy and the political opportunism of what was happening was that at about the same time, Salim Hamdan, who is an alleged driver for bin Laden, was released, and the Bush administration sort of poster detainee for its military commission system, the first person who was convicted in a very high-profile manner, was released to Yemen, as he should have been, but without objection by the CIA or the Defense Department, and without any discussion by Republican leaders of Yemen's ability to absorb him and deal with him. So that was sort of what was happening, and gradually, as the months into President Obama's term, in response to his efforts to close Guantanamo, which may have been genuine at one point, in response to pressure or attacks on him as being soft on terrorism, later in response to the shootings at Fort Hood, and pressure and demands to respond effectively, and how Major Hassan was linked later to the person who is the subject of our lawsuit now, Anwar al-Awlaki, and the Yemen connections. And then really, it's the turning point seemed to happen in December of 2009 with the attempted attack on an airliner in Detroit by an alleged Nigerian who, again, had alleged connections to al-Awlaki and Yemen, where you really see, a sort of bowing to political pressure and caving in, and the administration of President Obama going on the defensive, and an escalation of the administration's rhetoric and operations with respect to Yemen. And one of the first signs of this, as Tawakkol said, were joint operations that were conducted by the United States and Yemen in December of 2009, a series of raids and attacks that were carried out against alleged al-Qaeda members that resulted in the deaths of many civilians, dozens. Those operations were described at the time by anonymous administration officials as the most significant example of the, quote, new approach and greater willingness of the Obama administration to use military force to address terrorist suspects outside of traditional conflict zones like Afghanistan and Iraq. And then in early January of 2010, you see President Obama openly declaring that, quote, we are at war against al-Qaeda and we will do whatever it takes to defeat them. So in conducting this war, what the Obama administration calls a, quote, war against al-Qaeda, which is what the Bush administration called a war against terror, targeted killings have been taken up as a key strategy. And again, while these killings are nothing new, whether before or after 9/11, they have escalated in terms of the frequency of the strikes and the geographic scope where they're occurring. So the case that we recently filed, that CCR and the ACLU recently filed, tries to get at this policy, and specifically its implementation in Yemen. The specific subject is, as I said, a U.S. citizen and Yemeni citizen, a Muslim cleric by the name of Anwar al-Awlaki, whose targeted killing has essentially been authorized by the executive branch and specifically by President Obama because he's a U.S. citizen, and for authorization for U.S. citizens, specific permission of the president is required. He has been authorized through an entirely closed executive process on the basis of secret intelligence and secret standards for what could get someone put on one of these lists, authorized for killing. And he is being pursued in Yemen, which is a country, in our view, that the United States is absolutely not at war with, against, within, and that the law of peace should apply there, which would make this killing absolutely illegal. We can get into, in our question and answer, I don't want to be too long, what our reasons are for saying that this killing would be illegal. But the issue here is obviously about more than just the question of the legality of one of this person's killing, but about this authorization as part of a broader escalation by this administration of the use of lethal military force in a country like Yemen, which is not Afghanistan, it's not Iraq. Whatever one might say about the legitimacy of those wars, they are recognized as war zones. And the impact that that escalation is having on the ground and will have, both directly through the actions of the United States and through the actions of the Yemeni government, as Tawakkol and Izzeddin were saying, by the Yemeni government taking cover under this war against al-Qaeda to perpetrate its own abuses against activists and opposition to the government in the name of fighting al-Qaeda. As Layli was saying, an example of how this policy is, how the escalation of the war is increasing in Yemen. Just 2 weeks ago, the Washington Post reported, as Layli said, that the administration CIA officials have now described al-Qaeda in Yemen as the most urgent threat to U.S. security, which is prompting now administration officials to call for an escalation of not just U.S. military operations there, but adding armed CIA drones to its covert campaign of strikes. And these, again, are the same drones that have been terrorizing communities in Pakistan and causing the deaths of hundreds, if not more, of civilians there. Escalated military operations and airstrikes in Yemen have had and will obviously continue to have the same kind of devastating effect. They will continue to lead to destruction, unrest, instability, the kinds of things that war would bring to any country, let alone a country that is already struggling with its own challenges internally. And then it is this very instability, again, that the United States is creating and contributing to, that the U.S. is using to justify other policies. And on this point, I would just talk about the point about Guantanamo briefly. U.S. policy with respect to Yemeni detainees in Guantanamo right now is that there is an indefinite suspension on transfers to Yemen. Right now, there are about 178 men who remain detained, 8.5 years after the prison first opened, half a year after President Obama said it would be closed. Many of these men, most of them, have never been charged, have never even had the allegations against them reviewed by an independent body. They've remained in prison there on the allegations that they were enemy combatants and evidence that was gathered years ago under the Bush administration. So that evidence and information has never been reviewed. There's never been a determination of the legality of their detention, but most of the group of Yemenis who remain are these people. There are another group within the group of Yemenis, about a third of them, who have actually been completely cleared to leave by by a unanimous vote among every agency in the administration that has a stake in the matter, approved to leave Guantanamo, but they remain. And then there are also men who have actually had their habeas cases heard, the challenges to their detention heard, have been whose detention has been found unfounded or illegal, and they remain as well. Not because, again, of anything they've been alleged to have done or because they've been charged, but because of the country they're from and because the United States has deemed, again, Yemen to be a country that is incapable of receiving its own citizens because of unrest, again, that it is contributing to. And, you know, the turning point on this was really in December of 2009, again, after the attempted air attack on the airliner. That was sort of the turning point where this ban went into place. We had a client at CCR who was Yemeni, who was on a transfer plane of six Yemenis who were fortunately transferred days before the ban went into effect. He was one of the lucky ones. 3 or 4 days later, there was the ban, and people who were exactly in his position are still stuck at Guantanamo with bleak chances of getting out anytime soon. This is despite, again, the fact that the facts on the ground did not change in 3 days. Most of the people we're talking about have not been charged or had their allegations reviewed by a court, but it was really just a political moment where this ban went into effect. So I sort of abruptly end there. I think we've talked for long enough, but maybe we can open up for a question and answer now. Thank you very much.
We go now to hear from Tabakol Karmal,
chairwoman of the Yemeni non-government organization, Women Journalists Without Chains, which campaigns for freedom of the press in Yemen and against human rights violations. She's a very prominent activist and Reporters Without Borders chose her in 2009 as one of the top seven women who have led change in the world. Karman is among the activists who in 2007 launched the phase of protest and sit-ins in Yemen, which I hope she'll talk about more tonight. Holding regular sit-ins in the capital's Freedom Square to demand democratic reforms and an end to human rights violations, including the harassment and imprisonment of journalists and dissidents, closure of critical newspapers, and censorship of news articles. She is one of only 13 women on the Legislative Shura Council of the Yemeni Congregation for Reform, Islah, the leading opposition party. Her outspoken condemnation of the government's human rights abuses has inspired scores of other women activists to similarly resist injustice. She has helped write numerous articles on freedom of expression, corruption, extremism, and violent repression of dissidents in Yemen, and has called for political reform and dialogue. So thank you so much.
الأستاذ عز الدين طرح يعني ما يكفي في ما في في
How the United States and how the West in general deals with what they consider or the people they consider to be Islamist.
لكن عندنا إحنا في ال في ال في اليمن في شيء أيضا اسمه القاعدة فوبيا.
In Yemen we have something called Al-Qaeda phobia.
وأنا أحب أركز كثير على هذا الموضوع.
And I would like to concentrate on this subject.
إنه للأسف الشديد عودة إلى إنه المعارضين السياسيين الحقوقيين.
Let me explain what that means. Everyone in Yemen who is against the regime is accused of being Al-Qaeda member. To talk to you, to take this opportunity to talk to you about a real tragedy. In addition to what Leili just mentioned about Abdel Ilah Sharaf Kamal. And those two journalists are held right now.
هؤلاء معتقلين منذ أسبوعين اختطفوا بطريقة جدا سيئة من بيوتهم.
These are being detained for have been detained for 2 weeks now, and they have been kidnapped from their houses.
وقت الإفطار.
The breakfast or Ramadan breakfast time.
اقتحمت بيوتهم يعني حاصرت منازلهم قوات مكافحة الإرهاب.
They were their houses were surrounded by anti-terrorist task forces, and 30 to 40 soldiers went into their homes.
وأخفيوا لمدة يومين.
They disappeared for 2 days.
وإلى الآن هؤلاء معتقلين ولم يمكنوا حتى لا من حق زيارتهم ولا كذلك مع يعني توكيل محامي لهم.
Up till now they have been detained and they have not even had the right to visitation or the right to speak to an attorney.
والتهمة بأنهم بكل بساطة أن هؤلاء ينتمون إلى القاعدة.
And the only accusation is that they belong to Al-Qaeda.
وذلك صحفي الأول صحفي والآخر رسام كاريكاتير. كاريكاتيري.
One is a journalist and one is a caricaturist.
المشكلة الحقيقية التي أريد أن أوصلها إليكم ووعدت.
The main problem and that I really promised the people that I would convey to you, the people that are really interested in fighting for human rights.
وأعتقد أن بعضكم يعني تابع وكتبت عنها حتى نيويورك تايمز وهم مهجري القعاشين.
I think that the New York Times also wrote an article on this problem. This is the problem of the internally displaced in the area of Al-Gaashin.
هؤلاء مهجرين من وطنهم لهم 9 أشهر.
These villagers have been displaced for over 9 months now.
ومن قبل أحد شيوخ هذه المنطقة.
They were kicked out of their villages from one of from a tribal leader.
وهو عضو عضو مجلس شورى رئاسة الدولة يعني يمتلك الحصانة البرلمانية.
He was a member of the Shura Council, so he has parliamentary immunity.
هدم بيوتهم طردهم.
Destroyed their homes and he expelled them from their villages.
الآن نساء وأطفال
وأولاد. Women, children, and men all living in camps. Five villages altogether were expelled by this sheikh.
والآن يريد يقول أن هؤلاء قاعدة.
And now they're telling us, or he's telling us, that these people are Al Qaeda members.
فعشان تشوفوا كم يعني كم هو هذا المصطلح أصبح قبيح في اليمن وأصبح كيف يستخدم هذا الطاغوت.
This is just to tell you how this the name Al Qaeda became just an excuse to oppress people, to arrest people, and to mistreat them, and just how this name Al Qaeda became a scary name for anyone to be associated with. Coming back to the question about what we do on a daily basis to fight for human rights and especially the sit-ins in Liberty Place on every week.
إحنا منذ مايو 2007 دشنا مرحلة الاعتصامات في اليمن.
Since 2007, we started, inaugurated the period of sit-ins in Yemen.
للمطالبة لنيل الحقوق والحريات.
In order to get our rights and liberties.
وكانت النقطة الأولى هذا عندما منعنا نحن.
When we as women activists and journalists have been deprived or forbidden from owning newspapers,
وقفت خدمتنا الأخبارية بلا قيود موبايل.
Our information service, بلا قيود mobile service, has been shut down.
كنا يعني أول منظمة تستخدم هذه الخدمة الأخبارية عبر رسائل الـ SMS.
We were the first information network, information organization that uses the SMS technology in the area to spread information. We started to restore our service going through the regular official channels from one ministry to another, and we have been rejected at each and every time.
فقررنا لما لم نجد أي استجابة لمطالبنا قررنا الاعتصام بين رئاسة الوزراء ووزارة الإعلام ساحة اسميناها ساحة الحرية.
Our demands have been rejected every time. We decided to organize sit-ins in a square we called Liberty Square between the Ministry of Information.
ورئاسة الوزراء.
And the Prime Ministry and the Cabinet.
بدأنا من هناك يعني من هذه الساحة بدأت هي من الدعوة لإطلاق خدمتنا وصحيفتنا إلى الدعوة لإطلاق حرية التعبير كاملة.
So we started by demanding our right to reopen our service. And now the demands extended to open and to grant freedom of speech and freedom of press all over Yemen.
للدفاع عن حقوق النساء أيضا.
Fight for the rights of women as well.
للدفاع عن حقوق المعتقلين.
Who have been arrested and detained simply because they organized peaceful demonstrations or participated in peaceful demonstrations.
بدأنا بعشر نساء نعتصم في هذه الساحة.
At the beginning, we were only 10 women sitting in this Liberty Square.
الآن أحيانا يصل الاعتصامات في هذه الساحة إلى 3,000-4,000 نساء ورجال.
Sometimes we have 3,000 to 4,000 men and women sitting with us in Liberty Square.
That was Tawakkol Karmali speaking at the Brecht Forum recent event titled The United States in Yemen, Destroying Lives in the Name of National Security. Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss.
While many reports claim most U.S. troops are leaving Iraq, there will still be 50,000 troops remaining. 4,000 will be replaced by 7,000 security contractors. These are armed private contractors, former military, with specialized skills in weaponry, radar, and explosives. They will have less accountability in war zones. Meanwhile, massive permanent U.S. air bases remain, including the world's largest U.S. embassy in Baghdad. As the occupation in Iraq is privatized, veterans return back to the United States. We're joined today by conscientious objector and executive director of Iraq Veterans Against the War, Jose Vasquez. He helped organize numerous actions and events, including the Veterans and Survivors March to New Orleans, Operation First Casualty in New York City, and the Winter Soldier investigation of Iraq and Afghanistan.
Jose, I know we're here to talk to you today about Iraq and what the withdrawal means. You were in the military for a long time, but give us a little bit of background. I know first that we've had IVAW people on here before, Vets Against the War. You're the executive director of IVAW. What is IVAW and what do you do there?
Well, Iraq Veterans Against the War is a veterans membership-based organization. We are all folks who have served since September 11th, and what we call for is immediate withdrawal of all occupying forces from Iraq. We also have a resolution calling for the same on Afghanistan. We also want reparations for the people of Iraq and Afghanistan and full benefits for returning service members.
Now, I could go immediately to say, haven't we withdrawn from Iraq already? But I won't go there because first I want to get a little bit of your background here. When you say served since September 11th, you'd been in the military for some 14 years and you were about to be deployed to Iraq and then you didn't go. What happened?
So I was one of those people that signed up right out of high school. I graduated in 92 and went straight into active duty. I served 4 years as a reconnaissance specialist, cavalry scout, as it's called. And then I left the active duty, wanted to start going to college, joined the reserve, and reclassified as a medic, and later on as a nurse and a healthcare instructor. So I had been in the military for a while before September 11th, and I had a pretty good understanding of what our relationship was to Iraq. And I think, you know, when September 11th happened, I was here in New York going to school at City College, pursuing my bachelor's there. And I just had a lot of questions. I didn't really understand why it happened or, you know, why, what we were doing and how we were responding to it. It was just all very confusing to me. But at the same time, I was facing, you know, deployment. I was in the military already. I was a reservist. So it was pretty clear to me from day one. I mean, there were National Guardsmen all over the bridges and tunnels and all over town. So I knew that I was facing deployment, and I wasn't really worried about that so much, but it was more not having a full understanding of why I was being called up and where I was going. So that just led me on a path to kind of educating myself, and the more I learned, the more angry I got. Initially, we went into Afghanistan, and I think had I been deployed for Afghanistan, I didn't really have it figured out, and my politics weren't really fully formulated, so I would have gone, and we actually had a false call. We were mobilized or put on alert, but then we weren't mobilized. So fast forward to the Iraq War. I feel like when the conversation shifted pretty quickly, from Osama bin Laden and finding the folks who did this to Iraq. It just really, I didn't buy it from the beginning. I thought, you know, there's something fishy here. Again, just more internet research, and actually I stumbled across Democracy Now, thanks to WBAI. And I just started listening to that show pretty religiously, and that was the only place that I heard soldiers speaking out against the war. And once I figured out that I wasn't the only one who had questions about it, it really was kind of, you know, eye-opening to me. And at a certain point, probably around mid-2004, is when I really was just upset about the Iraq war and got to the point where I was like, I don't care what happens to me. I'm not going to this. I really do not support this. And so I started seeking, you know, ways to get discharged. And, you know, the options available to me were, say I was gay and get discharged under Don't Ask, Don't Tell, which would have been a lie. You know, try and get some sort of medical discharge, but I was, you know, in pretty good health. Some sort of hardship discharge, but none of my parents, you know, I'm definitely not the only kid in my family, and my parents were well. So really, conscientious objection was the only way out for me, other than going AWOL, which I also was not interested in doing, or going to Canada. Nothing against those guys who do that, but for me it was just, you know, Canada's too cold, I'm Puerto Rican, and that wouldn't have worked out for me. So I started researching conscientious objection, and it took me about 6 months to kind of come to the realization that this was right for me. You know, it took some time to, like, talk to my dad, who's a Vietnam vet, and I talked to a chaplain, I talked to other soldiers, and really it was a series of things during 2004 that sort of made me more and more angry. One example is the Abu Ghraib photos were released in April of 2004. We surrounded the city of Fallujah in 2004, so that was, like, in the news all the time. One of my good friends was deployed to Abu Ghraib, of all places, so that really kind of didn't sit well with me. And ultimately, what pushed me over the edge was the tsunami that happened at the end of 2004, which had nothing to do with Iraq, but it was just like so much death and destruction was on TV all the time. And there was a period where I couldn't sleep for like 2 or 3 weeks. And it was just at that point is when I realized, like, I'm not thinking like a soldier anymore. And so I decided to fill out the application, turn it in January of 2005. And then it was, you know, a comedy of errors after that. You know, the military really didn't know what they were doing. My unit certainly didn't know what to do with it. In fact, when I turned in my application, I also gave them the regulation because I knew they wouldn't have it and weren't familiar with it. So in February of 2005 is when I had to meet with my commanding officer, and, you know, they informed me that they would process the claim, but they were also giving me orders to Iraq, which is the rest of the unit was getting mobilized. So we shipped out in March of 2005, and we went to Fort Sam Houston in Texas. We were training up, getting ready to go. And the mission of the unit that I was in at that time was a medical training battalion. So we were going to some of us were going to be training soldiers stateside to get ready to deploy, and then some of us were going overseas to train the Iraqis on how to do medical skills. I was there and had shipped out, and because I knew about people like Camilo Mejia and Kevin Benderman, who had been court-martialed for refusing to deploy, I felt like, you know, I wanted to try the conscientious objector path and do it by the book. I decided, you know, instead of missing movement, that I would ship out with my unit. And so I, you know, if it meant going all the way to Iraq to get an answer on my claim, I was willing to do that. I was there in Texas for about 3 weeks, and then they called me in the office. There was a JAG officer there, and they said, well, you know, Staff Sergeant, we've been looking into your case, and you're not supposed to be here.
Wow.
So they had the regulation highlighted and, you know, showed it to me. And basically, once you initiate the conscientious objector process, whatever base you are at is where you're supposed to stay until it's, you know, until it comes to a resolution. So they gave me the option to come back to New York or stay in Texas. I asked them to give me a night to sleep on it, and I called my wife, and we talked about it. And ultimately, we decided that it would be best for me to come home. And I also felt like, you know, I wanted to stick it to my unit, you know, that they had screwed up, and I wanted to, like, come back and face them on that. In retrospect, I think it contributed to taking longer to get an answer on my claim because, again, the reserves and I think the National Guard is probably in the same boat in most states. They don't really deal with this on a day-to-day basis, so it's just, they really drug their feet on it. And the resources that you need, like access to a chaplain and access to a psychiatrist isn't always readily available on a reserve base. So I had to go all the way to West Point to get my – for the shrink to talk to me. I had to go to another base to talk to the chaplain. And ultimately, it, you know, took 27 months to get an answer. It wasn't until I went to see my Congresswoman, Carolyn Maloney, and her office that they sent a letter to the military. Within a month, I was discharged after they, you know, had that civilian oversight. So the military really doesn't like, you know, hearing from the elected officials. And and that was that's how I ended up getting out of the military.
Well, in a nutshell, what did you say in your application? You have to have a religious belief or something that substitutes for a deeply held religious belief. Can't just say I disagree politically with the war and its objectives. But what did you say to convince them?
And it has to be, it can't be a particular war. You have to be, if you just said, look, I didn't mind the other wars, but the Iraq war, I don't want to go to, they don't accept that.
Right.
So how did you answer both of those? And then we'll go to what's happening in Iraq now.
Sure, yeah. I think that's why it took me so long is because I had to sort of wrestle with the question of whether I'm against, you know, war in any form. And I had to kind of walk a tight rope there to really express my beliefs, but without expressing the anger that I had, particularly about the Iraq war. You know, the regulations say that your claim can be based on religious, moral, or ethical reasons. And so I kind of threw the kitchen sink at him, and I gave him all, you know, religious, moral, and ethical reasons why I was mm-hmm. against war. You know, in undergrad, I took some classes on Buddhism, and for a time I was interested in Buddhist religion, Zen Buddhist religion in particular, and I did some meditation, and I think that helped me to sort of focus and get some clarity on my own beliefs. I also talked about, you know, being in an anthropology program at CUNY, which I was surrounded by people that were all engaged in research that was very socially conscious, and they were very much involved with the people that they were doing research with. I also talked about human rights, and I attached the UN Declaration of Human Rights to my statement, and I talked about, you know, that these are the kind of principles that I'd like to live my life by, and that, you know, being in the military is contradictory to trying living those values. It was a pretty complex way to sort of present it, and I think in some ways if I had just said, you know, I'm a Christian and I'm born again and this is what I believe, it would have been easier for me to do it that way. But I laid it out and showed it to some folks that were lawyers and friends of mine that were philosophers, and, you know, got some feedback on it. And there were some stuff that, you know, people advised me, you should probably take that out. It sounds a little too political. You should, you know, tone that down a little bit. So I took that advice, and ultimately I think it worked out for the best, you know. And in the meantime, as the application was processing, is when I got involved with IVAW, when I met someone, another soldier, a guy from Brooklyn, who's actually one of the founding members of IVAW. You know, once he told me that the organization was welcomed anyone who served after 9/11, I sort of hit the ground running and helped start the chapter here in New York. I served on the board. I helped organize Winter Soldier in 2008. And, you know, here I am now as the executive director.
Let's go to where we are today. And
sure.
It's a great story. I mean, an amazing story, really. It's unusual, to put it mildly. But let's go to where we are today. I know I asked you before we sat down, did you listen to Obama's speech about the withdrawal from Iraq? And, of course, in the last few days, we've had a couple of U.S. soldiers sadly killed in Iraq. What do you make of Obama's speech and the idea that combat operations have ended? What's left in Iraq? Just your impression. What's going on? And have any part of IVAW's demand been met? What is this?
I guess I'll start with Obama administration and the speech. I feel like, you know, this group definitely has their finger on the pulse in terms of marketing and branding and sort of messaging and getting people to sort of buy into this idea of hope and change and all of this stuff. So, you know, I definitely would prefer Obama over Bush, especially during those long 8 years, the dark ages of the Bush administration. But at the same time, was not one of those people that was standing in Times Square and crying when Obama got into office. I think it's extremely significant that an African American is the president of the United States. I think that shows that we've come a long way. But at the same time, I sort of felt like we were being sold a bill of goods. And they've made some important legislative decisions. But at the same time, I feel like their foreign policy hasn't really changed all that much. In fact, you know, Obama made no bones about the fact that his view was we need to shift our focus from Iraq to Afghanistan, and that Afghanistan is the good war, and that's where we need to be and to focus our energy. And that's exactly what they're doing, is, you know, rebranding the occupation in Iraq to some sort of Occupation Light or Operation New Day. You know, but
New Dawn, I think.
New Dawn, right. But 50,000 troops in Iraq, to me, all of whom are armed, and you can call them non-combat troops if you like, but the fact is their mission is to train the Iraqi National Guard and to be advisors, which means that in many cases they're still going to be going on patrols and on the front lines and just as vulnerable to IED attacks and those sorts of things. The other thing is they're trying to say, well, we've drawn down the troops to 50,000, which, you know, in relation to how many of troops have been there in the past, sure, that's less than before. But I think what they're skimming over is how many contractors are on the ground, security contractors and otherwise. And so from the perspective of an Iraqi person, Americans running around with guns in their country has not really diminished all that much. I think there have been some significant progress in terms of the number of daily attacks and sort of day-to-day violence. But I also feel like as we pull out, it still remains to be seen what sort of power struggle there will be within within the country. I think we owe the people of Iraq a lot, you know, as much destruction as we've waged there. But at the same time, you know, a military solution to this problem is, you know, is what has contributed to it going on as long as it has. I think there have been just, you know, tremendous missteps and a lot of death and destruction for what, yeah, I don't know what we've actually accomplished.
What were the stated aims and what were the real aims, do you think, of the United States going into Iraq? And secondly, what were the consequences of the invasion? What's been done to Iraq?
Well, I think this whole idea of the weapons of mass destruction, which pretty quickly became evident that that was all a myth. This mostly has to do with us positioning ourselves with access to the resources that they have, oil resources and otherwise, and that it's a global competition for scarce resources with countries like China and Russia and you know, India and other places. So I feel like, you know, what we were told every 6 months to a year, the Bush administration would tell us a different reason why we needed to be there, all of which turned out to be pretty empty. And I think the Obama administration was sort of handed this mess and needed to figure out a way. And, you know, this is their answer, is to say that combat operations are over and now we're in this whole new phase of the operation. But I still think that, you know, the footprint that'll be left behind there, I think, is a lot larger than most people realize, and that, you know, we're most likely going to have permanent bases unless there's some serious pressure around that. And us being able to dictate how the oil laws are written there, the fact that, you know, the people who work in the oil industry still can't organize in Iraq, and the fact that we're complicit in that and not keeping those Saddam Hussein era laws on the books in terms of not allowing oil workers to organize, we're totally fine with that. And that's going to definitely have an impact on their ability to sort of rebuild their economy.
Jose Vasquez from Iraq Veterans Against the War. Talk to us about what the effect of the American invasion and occupation was on the people of Iraq in terms of death and migration, destruction, and so on.
I've seen tons of interviews with Iraqis, for example, that they're asked point blank, well, are things better now that the Americans are here? And I think maybe there was an initial sort of euphoria about Saddam Hussein being out of power. But at the same time, very basic things like water and just, you know, security, day-to-day living there really deteriorated to the point where it was just completely unsafe for children to go to school and for folks that were out of work. You know, most of these people that were called insurgents were really kind of day-to-day people that, you know, were angry about the fact that the Americans were in their country. I think there's a wide range of estimates in terms of how many people have been killed in Iraq, you know, and I think that there should seriously be an accounting of that, you know.
I've read a million, and right. 4 million displaced from their homes, and even more than that who have fled.
Right. the impact of that, I think, is going to reverberate for generations in Iraq. Depleted uranium rounds that were used in, you know, different bunker busting bombs and all of this thing. I think there's already evidence that the rates of cancer and birth defects and that sort of thing. Depleted uranium is considered the Agent Orange of our time or our generation here. It's having an impact on the troops that are coming back as well as the Iraqi civilians that still live there. It's going to affect their ability to engage in agriculture and that sort of thing. So, and just, you know, major infrastructure, roads and bridges and dams and all of these things were damaged during our time there, not to mention, you know, the cultural history that was lost during the looting following the kind of, you know, lack of security and the fact that we, you know, were really irresponsible in how we secured things like the oil ministry and or, you know, and other facilities like that, but completely ignored the museums and all of these other things. So I don't even know if you can put a price tag on that, but that's a huge issue. And the fact that with the American presence there and the fact that we have the largest embassy, you know, in the world is in Baghdad, the huge impact that we have on their ability to just, you know, be a sovereign nation and determine their own affairs.
Is there a way for our listeners to get in touch with you, Jose?
Sure. You can check out our website. It's ivaw.org, based here in New York City. You can also email us at ivaw@ivaw.org. And our phone number is 646-723-0989.
And are you planning any kind of demonstrations or other actions in the near future?
A couple of things. So there's the October 2nd One Nation Working Together. So we're in touch with the folks that are organizing the peace contingent of that on October 2nd, Saturday. And October 7th is the anniversary of the invasion of Afghanistan. So we're actually planning to launch a campaign which will work on stopping the deployment of traumatized troops. So folks that are dealing with PTSD, traumatic brain injury, or military sexual trauma. There are folks that are being deployed as we speak to Iraq or Afghanistan who are dealing with those issues, and we want to bring that to the fore.
Because I know it's Iraq Veterans Against the War, but you've talked a bit about Afghanistan. So obviously your organization includes soldiers who fought in Afghanistan as well, and you have a demand for, again, withdrawal from Afghanistan. Just give us a sense of what you see as the picture in Afghanistan right now.
Sure. Well, I mean, I think that the buildup of the troops there and the kind of precarious situation between Afghanistan and Pakistan, drone attacks that we're using to deal with that issue. I read recently that no surprise, the IED attacks are on the rise in Afghanistan, and I feel like I'm not even an expert on the history of Afghanistan, but I know enough to understand the moniker that is put on Afghanistan as the kind of graveyard of empires. And, you know, we're in a situation that I think we need to seriously scale back whatever goals we might have in terms of nation building there. It's going to be a long-term problem for us. And we're going to see more and more Afghan civilian deaths and the same for American troops. You know, the Obama administration needs to take a serious look at what their goals are there. You know, from our perspective, it's already been too long, and we've been there almost 10 years now, and, you know, we haven't really accomplished all that much. So we need to figure out how to pull our troops out of there expeditiously and cut our losses as soon as possible.
Well, Jose, thank you for being with us. It's a really heroic story you've told, as well as important information about both Iraq and Afghanistan. So thank you, and thanks to Iraq Vets Against the War and to WBAI and Amy for bringing you the soldier stories that got you to be a conscientious objector.
Great. Thank you.
Thank you, Jose.
If you have any comments or questions about this segment or any others, please visit us at lawanddisorder.org.